It is Saturday, November 17th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, our Week in Geek News and your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during this show are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we are covering the week in geek news, and during the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can also go to geekspeak.org and send us email. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, a Slacker student.
Good morning.
Are you a Slacker student or a Slacker geek and student?
Slacker. Well, actually, I'm neither. I've been pretty busy lately. So
you have been busy. Yesterday, you sent me an email like, okay, student canceled on my tutoring session, so I've got 10 minutes to send you an email.
Yeah.
That's basically what your life's like right now?
Yeah.
Poor guy. Going away on vacation, too.
Yeah, you're like, so you don't have kids. I'm...
And speaking of kids, Sean's not joining us this week because his daughter's a little sick. That's too bad. But we do have Ryder Brooks, another father, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Ryder Brooks, hi.
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning. Let's start off the show with some geek news. Should we start with Miles?
Sure, we can start with me. I have a story that I wanted to read last week, but then got sidetracked.
Because I hate you. I'm so sorry.
And it's about a monitor drawing zero power in standby. A lot of press has been coming on lately about how much power, how much we get from phantom charges. In other words, all those wall warts, the big transformers that are attached to the block on the wall. And we have TVs and the like that use up, you know, 5 watts at a time. All those add up to approximately 8% of all domestic electricity in the U.S.
Whoa, 8% is just bleed?
8% is just bleed.
Wow.
Just for those devices so that you can hit a remote control and have it be able to listen to you and turn on.
Right. And other reasons. But here's an interesting thing you can do in your house to get a feel for how much this is happening. Just turn off everything so everything's off and unplug your fridge and then go out to your meter and see how fast it's spinning. That's the bleed we're talking about. And you're saying that's about 8% of the U.S. consumption of – I bet it's not just power. I bet it's home power. But anyway.
Yes, it's domestic electricity.
Domestic. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Okay. I bet that you just said domestic. All right, go on. So what's the monitor?
This monitor uses a set of capacitors and relays to avoid drawing power. In other words, it takes a certain charge to begin with while the monitor is in use. And then when it goes into standby mode, instead of drawing power from the wall, it just uses that reservoir in order to do the things that a monitor would normally do. In other words, look for whether there's a signal coming from the computer or not, to know whether to turn on and display the screen or just to leave the screen off.
Right, because that detection current probably is pretty low. You probably don't need much to power electricity to deal with that issue.
Right.
So instead of saying, oh, let's just rely on that 9-volt source as always being there because we've got a wall wart, we'll just use it all the time, instead just turn that off completely.
Right. I should mention it's Fujitsu Siemens who's trying to push this technology in
their
monitors.
You know, when you said this, I assumed you meant while the monitor is displaying an image, it had no power draw.
Oh, no.
This is like paper, like electronic paper. You're talking about standby. Okay.
Yeah, this I think is going to be one of many applications in the future for we have a lot of devices that do have that phantom power to be able to do something like that.
Okay, so here's a technical issue with why that's actually kind of impressive that they're doing that. And that's not actually technical. It's more, I guess, legal. Anyway, there's a few different things you have to do to make electronics that you can sell in the United States and in Europe. The Europe spec is called a CE, and electronic spec. And if you look on your devices, you'll see this mark. It's a C and an E next to each other. And what happens is, for you to release a product that has electronics in it, you have to pass certain certifications. And the certifications are varied depending on how much power you're running through this thing. So if it's a high voltage device, like a refrigerator, for example, that takes 110 straight into it, you've got to get more testing on it compared to a small device that has like 9 volt power. So the way you can do this relatively effectively is a manufacturer makes a power block, one of those little transformers, and that block is certified CE and outputs 9 volts. Now, that's the high voltage thing and it's pre-certified. And then all these other manufacturers just use that block and ship it with their device. And then they can do the spec of the low voltage certification, mm-hmm. which is a lot cheaper. So to do this kind of smart electronics, either you have to make the brick communication smarter or you have to put the transformer inside the monitor.
And chances are that with most monitors, the transformer is within the monitor.
It's
you just have
common,
a straight power cable going.
Right. And mostly because, of course, I mean, CRTs especially have high voltage sources. The flat screens don't actually need high voltage sources. They can run off like 12 volts. So you could do it at the outside. So is this one...
Really? I mean, most LCDs are somewhere in the range of like 50 watts. So...
Yeah, the wattage isn't really the issue. The voltage point is actually the issue. So, well, this monitor behind me, Miles, does it have a transformer block or is the power going into it? Or not behind me, in front of me.
Looks like a transformer block,
actually. Right. So, and it's probably a 12-volt
transformer. Yeah, it's a DC
block. Yeah. How much the voltage?
I can't see from here.
All right, because you have bad eyes. So
but it's not just altruistic. I mean, it's not just saying, okay, we want to do something for the environment. There are political parties in Europe calling for a ban on that standby, on that phantom bleed.
That makes sense, especially if it's 8%. I mean, it's a major level. Now, do you know what this – is this Toshiba that you say?
This is Fujitsu.
Fujitsu
Siemens. Yeah.
And Fujitsu Siemens, are they making the power block smarter? Is there some kind of communication going on to the power block?
No, it's not with a power block.
It's right in
the transformers within the monitor itself.
That's the thing I think would make it more ubiquitous is if you take and upgrade a standard to the power blocks. And I've wanted this for a while because you know how you take your you have all these
and then
little
put a communication line?
A communication line inside the line. And the reason for it has twofold. One, the device can say, hey, go ahead and give me 12 volts. And the device can go, I'm sorry, I can't do that because I'm an 8-volt power supply and not do it at all. And you can the polarity of the voltage could be modified by the power block. So if you had smarter power devices, you could deal with this issue as well.
How much do you think that would add to cost?
I don't know. But if it's a regulatory thing, it won't really matter because mm-hmm. everybody will have to do it, and therefore the price will be up, and we'll just eat the cost.
You know, a very simple solution to that is just put everything on a power strip, turn that power strip off.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't work for all – because, I mean, when you have a power strip, you end up with the blinking 12 o'clock all the time for some devices.
For some, yeah. I mean
– for those clocks.
Well, VCR, some DVD players.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there needs to be a whole revolution of being able to tinker stuff. Like, why can't – I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult to open up your VCR, find the device that actually does the clock, throw a – you know, a 9-volt battery inside the circuit inside the device, a rechargeable 9-volt battery, and just you can unplug it and the clock will work. It just won't display. That kind of thing is not that hard technically to do. Why isn't it done?
I don't know. And with regard to the
power computers,
it's because electricity is too cheap. If electricity was more expensive, we would have mm-hmm. devices that conserved it more. Sorry, one of you were going to say something more.
I was going to say, with regard to the power strip, that can work well for a computer if you just want a single point to turn on. But if you think of stereo equipment, a lot of times you have a remote control and you go to turn on the stereo. The ability to use that remote control is dependent upon that 5-watt draw that's coming off the wall. Mm-hmm. So if you hit the power strip, 5 volt.
Well, it's all about efficiency versus convenience.
No, actually, a lot of them end up being about 5 watts.
5 watts of just wasted power?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's a lot of power.
Yeah, that's typical for monitors. And
I'm going to start switching all my
This is why it's 8% of domestic electricity.
Yeah, that's a lot of power.
A lot of these things are adding up to a lot of power.
Yeah. I was looking up, I guess the Xbox 360 has always been known to be like really hot and inefficient because of the size of the chips on it, the GPU and CPU chips. And I guess they recently scaled down the chips to like a 65 nanometer instead of the 90 nanometer they were at. and huge savings in energy. You were looking like 25% efficiency changes. I was looking at the charts, but the one place where it took a beating was in standby mode. It actually drew more current than the original one.
Interesting. Which of course, it's off most of the time.
Yeah.
Something that just came to mind, I realize we're spending a lot of time on the story, but timers. You know, they're mechanical timers. The electricity allows it to turn over time. Setting one of those up for your stereo equipment, because you never, most people that are older, don't use their stereo at 3 in the morning. Or the like, having or
just
while
having
they're at
it
work,
turn off and turn on based on your schedule.
Right, exactly.
That's pretty
so
amazing.
Then you can still use the remote control, but then you're not leaving it on all the time.
And I think there are actually power strip technologies that do something similar to that now, where they have timers on them.
I'd love to see any of those. If we had links to that, I'd put it up on the website.
Yeah, I'll look it up. I remember Oprah Winfrey did a Green Week. And they covered this on one of them.
And they had timered.
I can't remember if it was a timer thing or if it was just an intelligent layout where it would, when you turn it off, only some of them would go off that were critical to it.
You know, when we talk about these like other power sources and new kinds of generators and stuff, we get a plethora of calls and emails and letters from people that are off the grid that listen to radio as their primary source of information. And they hear, you know, a new type of generator or whatever. And it's always someone that's off the grid, either on a boat, in a alternative home, out in the woods, totally off the grid. And those are the people that are completely focused on how can I conserve, because they're running, they're charging their battery. They know about their electronics needs. Yeah. Yeah. And most people are completely oblivious to it. There's no concern to it. So it feels to me like there should be some kind of capitalistic incentive to conserve electricity. I guess there is. Those home devices that are
speaking of off the grid. There's a certain laptop that is made for people off the grid.
That's a good segue
that you just purchased. So
it's true.
What's that about, Lyle?
Well, hang on just a second. Hey Ben, if you're close, come on by. Okay, I can't take his call because we're on air. But So the one laptop per child, which you first told me about. It's
right,
a great program. Why don't you give us the backdown on the one laptop per child?
I've talked about it before. It's the idea is there are many countries that, you know, they have running water, they have roads, but basic education is really what's lacking, and the time to get teachers and the like. And the idea is to get these really cheap laptops so that they can access the internet to be able to do a lot of their own research, or if you're in a classroom environment, have this directed learning where you don't have to worry about getting a new textbook because you can just put it onto the laptop.
Right, like there's no textbook possibilities, really. Right. And then there's also this whole idea of your kids are walking for 3 hours to get to their school. So if they leave during that time with some kind of materials they can keep working on, it's great, but they don't have the resources to give all the kids books. So this is the kind of ideas I mean, there's a lot of good reasons for
that
it.
That and the laptop, everything about the laptop is open source. So if they want to learn how the computer works, just learning about computer technology, learning how a program works, they can look at the source of any program that's running on
the
system.
And the general idea is to jumpstart in a complete generation of underdeveloped countries' children into the information age.
Right, or just get them access to information to be able to look up how do I set up a aquifer or set up a aqueduct or how do I set up these.
So the idea was this whole program to generate these laptops and software to run on the laptops, which is a very important part of it, actually probably more complicated than the hardware itself.
Although the hardware is extremely impressive.
It's pretty impressive. And send these off to basically what you do is an aid package to a country. Part of it would be education-based, and the country would then say, okay, we're going to use that money to buy these laptops. It's a nonprofit organization that's actually creating the laptops, so really it's very, I don't know, it's very beautiful. So the laptops are there, and they're actually been released like mid-November. They're actually in production. They're happening, and we're seeing samples of them. And one of the things that they mentioned a couple months ago was you can, starting in November – the 14th, I think, you can buy a laptop. You'll spend twice as much money. The laptops cost
a little
about
$200. More than twice. Well, it's a little bit more than twice.
Right. So they say we'll take $400 from you. You'll get one of these laptops, and we'll ship one of these laptops to somebody else, which is a great. Somebody
it's
in the third world.
The cost of your laptop, the cost of the other child's laptop, plus the cost of shipping.
Yeah, and the delivery and setup costs, kind of thing. So you're basically donating a laptop to this program. You're kind of helping do that, and you get to get a laptop for a kid. And it's really interesting on the site. I think of this laptop as so cool that I want to use it myself, but really, they're designed for children. You really have to understand that.
Right, and the keyboard's going to be really small.
Yeah, it's not really going to be that functional for an adult. So So one of my I work at UCSC in the Digital Arts New Media MFA program, and one of my faculty members, Sharon Daniels, saw when this came out that we'd be able to buy one in the United States. And that's one of the things, is that they're not targeted for commercial use. So she said, go ahead and try to get one. So I'm using state UCSC funds to get two of these to do research in the field of ways of enlightening, or basically getting a handle on this new generation of people that will have these devices, so we can do our research off of those. So they're kind of her. Most of her work is I should speak more eloquently about her work, but it's pretty impressive stuff. I'll put some links on the GeekSpeak site. Sharon Daniels' work has some wonderful stuff. For example, one of the pieces is sending all these cheap video cameras to a group of people in an underdeveloped area, allowing them to tell their story and edit the videos up on a website so everybody can see what their life is like. So that's the kind of social documentation kind of stuff that she does. It's pretty interesting. And we wanted to take a look at these laptops to fulfill that same need. So I went through a lot of process to actually get a couple, and did order a couple just the other day. So we'll see them, and we'll talk about them on air, and I'll bring them in, and we'll play with them before we get them into research. Pretty neat stuff. And you can buy one too. And I guess right now, I guess it's open for about another 12 days. And then it closes off, and you shouldn't be able to get one in the U.S. anymore. So if you're interested in one of these laptops, it costs it's $400 for a laptop, but actually you're also giving $400 giving a laptop to somebody else. And they say the earlier orders, so get it in now, they'll probably ship them to you before Christmas. So if you want to give a laptop to a child, now's the time. And these things should work child should be able to use one of these laptops relatively effective without being literate. Because that's part of the laptop, is it teaches you literacy. So we'll see. I'm pretty excited about it. All right. That was your story?
That was your story.
But you queued me up for it.
Yes. All right. You should say thank you.
Thank you, Miles.
But it is one of the things about the one laptop per child is it's a political issue. And speaking of political issues.
Wow. So fluid.
Barack Obama is... saying that if he becomes president of the United States, he's going to name a chief technology officer.
What's he
going
to name him? Sorry.
Now, this is different than the current title of a technology czar, which is what Bush has been talking about as a guard against hacking attempts by other countries and watching out for the security of our domestic networking infrastructure.
What is this IT person?
The chief technology officer would be in Obama's hypothetical
administration
would be someone who would make sure that information having to do with the presidency is made available and online for people to view.
We need the mood music when you do that. You mean transparency in government?
Right. That's the main goal. And one of the things he was talking about was, for example, after Congress has signed a bill and he's going to be deciding whether to sign the bill into law or to veto it, to put the text of that bill up onto the website for comment for 5 days, 5 or 6 days. And after he got the comments, then vote on it. So that if there was something that was just, someone was trying to slip it through, that there wasn't an immediate, it's like, okay, we're just going to sign this and that'll be the end of it. To have some transparency to see what's going on and to actually give feedback.
Nice. I got to say, I think it's a wonderful idea to make more of government transparent. And so is the question I have, though, is aren't there already technical, chief technology officers in the administration's upper ranks? Doesn't Bush have a chief technology officer?
Are you aware of a website for you to go to check on bills and have any input?
No, but that might be because of their style of governing.
Another thing that the CTO would be charged with doing is ensuring the government officials hold open meetings. And broadcast live webcasts of those meetings.
That sounds so great.
So, having a whole technology infrastructure to allow access and having everyone fly to Washington, D.C. isn't an option.
Right.
So why not have the ability for you to open up a web browser and take a look at it? And that's what he's proposing.
It's wonderful. One of the – speaking of open government and video sourcing of the content of what our government's doing, one of the other projects in the program that I work for, Digital Arts New Media, is a project called Medavid. You can look at it, medavid.ucsc.edu, and it is a online resource of searching the video of the House and Senate floors of the United States. So since January of 2006, you can find out what our congresspeople are speaking about and senators are speaking about on the floor. another one of those things.
Or more specifically, finding out about a particular topic or keyword.
Yeah, you can do a searches off of what they've been talking about and see the video.
That was the most impressive thing that I saw about that.
Yeah. And that's growing, too. They've got a Sunlight Foundation grant to improve it. But in general, this idea that, you know, you and I can basically put our entire lives online at our, you know, because we're geeks and it's easy to do that. But our government doesn't, even though they work for us. It's kind of humorous to me. But get back to the point. Do you assume then that there's never been a chief administration officer in the administration of our government? I mean, that seems insane.
I believe that it hasn't been a public facing figure.
Ah, okay.
And this is pretty much what the person would be doing. I'm sure there is for just the general email infrastructure.
Right.
Although I don't know if it will be a CTO rather than just being an email administrator.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm really questioning. It seems insane to me. Like I was saying before the show, you and I have worked for each other a lot. There's always been a CTO at the companies.
Well, things move slowly. For example, we still vote on a Tuesday. As a bit of trivia, you want to know why we vote on a Tuesday?
No, moving on. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Why do we vote on a Tuesday?
It's because back in the day, it took people didn't live in the major cities a lot of times, and you had to have travel time.
Oh, that's great. So, that's why it's not on Monday.
And you didn't have it on – you couldn't do it on Sunday.
We're a Christian nation. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so Monday, you travel to the city. You got a place to stay. Then you voted on Tuesday morning, and you spent the rest of Tuesday going back home.
Wow.
That's why we vote on Tuesdays.
That's when we had a dedicated populace.
That's why we have voting on Tuesdays now. I mean, if that gives you an idea of how steeped in tradition the old way of doing things, like sticking with how we do it, then it doesn't seem all that strange that we don't have a CTO in government.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that update on Obak's plan to put a CTO in his administration.
Barack,
thank you. I had this really cool this guy in high school. His name was what did I just say?
Obak,
and he was the coolest kid in high school. So that's what was in my mind.
Next is going to be Chewbacca Obama.
Moving on, Ryder. Hi.
Okay. So I found a little bit of interesting bits. I'm always kind of intrigued with technology that comes out that's about increasing our bandwidth and technologies to, increase throughput for our pleasure of cruising the internet. So there was Tohoku University in Japan came up with a way of compressing data using existing protocols for fiber optics to squeeze out terabytes of information per second.
Which is a lot.
Using quadrature amplitude modulation, which is existing technology that is used in some digital TV tuners and wireless data connections. But they've basically developed a new laser. Typically, they use it over radio waves. It basically needs a concise frequency that's not interruptible. And they were having problems with that with fiber optics. So they developed their own laser that basically does it, a special laser to...
Actually, it's part of the component itself.
Yeah.
Cool. Anybody know what quadrature amplitude modulation is?
Wikipedia
does. Yeah. It does. It's quadrature amplitude modulation is a modulation scheme that conveys data by changing the amplitude of two carrier waves, in short.
Oh, okay.
These two waves usually sinusoids, adiphase, and with each other by 90%, and that's called quadrature carriers, hence the name of the scheme. Maybe you know more about that than I do.
I understand what you're saying now.
Yeah. So, but in short, you know, a lot of data in a lot of short time. And they're basically talking about, you know, serving up high-definition movies within seconds.
But the thing that always is interesting to me is that you have to have all the technologies kind of rise at the same time. I'm sure really high transfer rate's cool, but where do you put the data? You can't store it on a hard drive. The hard drive doesn't write that fast. So you've got to have an array of hard drives or faster hard drive technology. And, of course, you get really fast hard drive technology. Like, what are you going to do with that data? Because you can't use it fast enough.
When you start talking about solid-state drives, I mean, that's going to take
care of that. Can solid-state write that fast? And they have fast access times, but their read-write times aren't necessarily...
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you can...
There's drives out there. I mean, given that there are, you know, read-write limitations with solid-state flash memory, you also have RAM memory. I've seen these recently where they're just upping them. They're kind of putting them in drive cages, and you can stick 16 gigs or more into these kind of pseudo hard drive cases, and it's really just active RAM that has a battery charge.
Usually a battery backup. Yeah.
And those are typically very pricey, but they are considered the fastest drives available. So You would have to have a lot of RAM to cache, you know, a high definition
movie seconds.
but yeah, and so there's that, and then there's also another article I came across where they've managed to squeak out about 100 gigabytes out of copper wire. Another U.S. university, and where'd that link go here?
Okay, well, let's talk about that in just a second. Sure. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers, though I'll repeat them in just a moment, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can, on any day of the week, you can give us an email. Just go to geekspeak.org. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP, which you are listening to, and this is GeekSpeak. The geeks in the room with me, making me sound more intelligent, which isn't difficult, is Ryder Brooks and Miles Elam. We're all taking your calls this morning with questions and comments of technology, anything you'd like. The phone number is 476-2800. Of course, that's in the 831 area code, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. KUSP. Of course, you can go to the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org to send us email. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services, including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. All right. You were saying, while we wait for calls?
So in the labs, you know, U.S. universities and engineers at Penn State University are claiming that they are able to get about 100 gigabytes per second over 100 meters using Category 7 CAT cabling.
And how different is Category 7?
It's a little different. It's four pairs of twisted copper wire.
That sounds similar to Cat 5.
Very similar. I think it's just more densely twisted in order to achieve it. And
densely twisted or just has better shielding?
I don't think they have shielding still. I don't think you want shielding with twisted pair, but I'm not certain about Earth with Cat 5. But normally what they do is they get the perfect cable and they say, can we do this? And it might be even a Cat 5 cable, but the tolerance is such that it matches to a Cat 7 spec, and which is basically just tighter tolerances. That's what it normally is when you deal with Category 5 changes. And the biggest issue with Cat 5 is the head design. So any category... I guess they're not Category 5, Category 6. Ethan, what are those called besides Category 5?
Cat 5E?
Yeah, that's extended.
Cat 5 enhanced, I guess, Category 6 and 7.
But what is it, Category 5, Category 6 of what? Is it some kind of cable?
Twisted pair.
Twisted pair, Category 5.
Yeah, twisted pair RJ45.
But that's the head. Interesting. I never really thought about, like, what's the... is there another name for it? Like, it's probably a request for comment spec.
All of those versions have had... 8 cables, 4 pairs.
Yeah, I know.
And they've all been the same arrangement. It's just a question of...
They don't always have 4 pairs.
It looks like ISO/IEC 1181.
That's what we should start calling it.
Yeah, back with 10...
say it again, ISO C.
It's ISO IEC, and then it's 11801.
So, of all the... never mind.
Yeah, 10 megabit, had a lot of ground lines. That a lot of the pairs were being used as ground lines.
The 10 megabit in my office, half duplex 10 megabit in my office, is actually just two pairs. Four lines.
Actually used for data.
That are connected in the cable. Mm-hmm. The cable is empty besides those two.
Really?
Yeah. I'm almost positive of it. And I know it's really loose. In any case, cool. High bandwidth through Cat 7.
You know, and back to that point about the 100 terabits per second. Clearly, no single computer can use that kind of throughput of its own. But if you consider that as your company's input for networking or, you know, your neighborhood even. I mean, that's awesome bandwidth. So shared.
Awesome.
I'll split bandwidth. It with you. How's that?
That sounds good to me. Yeah. Yeah. A little difficult. We kind of live far away. Actually, you could move in my neighborhood. You're looking for a place, right?
That's right.
So you're looking for what? A 3-bedroom house?
Yeah, whatever I can afford, ideally, yeah.
A cheap
right now
house.
It's a 1-bedroom shack.
And you're looking for rental. So if you want to have a really cool geek living close to you, just drop us a line. You've got a 3-bedroom house for him and his wife and child. There's a little plug for finding a house. Wouldn't that be cool? That'd be a first. House finding on radio. In Santa Cruz, Mary, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks. I was reading the articles in the San Jose Mercury about cyber fraud and people using my computer when I'm not aware of it to chain together bunches of computers and then leasing.
And they effectively scared you with no solutions.
No. Well, I had a couple ideas, so okay. I thought I'd run them by you and see.
Go for it.
My logic is, well, the first one was, can I just turn off my computer?
Yes.
And then second, I was actually even thinking if that wasn't sufficient, I would just unplug my DSL when I wasn't using it.
Yep. Those are both pretty good solutions. The thing is, those don't really solve the complete problem because, of course, but no, that's pretty good.
I would suggest
getting rid of any kind of threat that's on your machine, making sure you scan it and removing any kind of applications.
Yes.
Right. Turning off your computer would work against having your computer being co-opted or being used by someone else for nefarious purposes.
As would unplugging the DSL.
Right.
And I thought those were just awfully simple. I mean, if I locked my front door when I leave my house, why would I leave my computer accessible to anybody who wants to use it?
Well, okay, let's use that analogy. The problem with that idea is that if you have your house unlocked while you're in it, which you have to basically with a computer, we're using kind of mixed metaphors here, but and then there's ninjas that are stealing stuff from your house. You'll never see them, but they'll be in your house. And that's kind of what the cybercrime is.
Right.
So, you know, then you can lock the door, but if they're already inside the house, they can just still use your stuff.
Right, but only when it's on.
Right, unfortunately, of course, they want that communication line.
So I was thinking that everyone should just, you know, just like in also the power safe stuff you were talking about earlier, shut everything down, and at least part of the time you won't be being used by somebody else.
I agree. I think it's a great idea. The one thing I would say is instead of unplugging your, well, now DSL, you can unplug and it'll resync.
I can unplug it. I could use an AV box on it, you know.
Yeah. I like that. I think it's a good idea.
Okay.
Save power in the process.
Yeah. Save power in the process. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the suggestion.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Hey, is there international turn off your computer day? You know, something like that, like bike to work day, but don't be on a computer day. Is there that?
I don't know. The world would fall apart.
Is that Thanksgiving, maybe?
Can you imagine, like, you know.
Not when you're going to have your computer off.
Imagine somebody at, like, the stock market in New York going, oh, it's turn off power day.
As long as the train, well, anyway. From Loveland, Colorado.
Yes.
Sean, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Howdy. How you doing?
Good.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is, first off, preface, I'm a brand new Mac user and been using Windows since Windows existed. And I've been using a personal database software called Ultra Recall because I've got a memory like a sieve. And I'm looking for an equivalent software in the Mac realm.
Uh-huh.
And basically what I need is a way of bringing in its database software so it's I can bring in the information, it indexes it, I can search it, and it's
like a personal management tool?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's like a personal management tool to some degree?
Kind of like a PIM,
yeah.
But it's more oriented toward dragging and dropping in any kind of file with any kind of text in it and having the application dig through it. And
there's a whole bunch of these. They're called productivity tools. If you go to apple.com downloads and the category productivity, I think it is, you'll find a whole bunch of these.
Great.
And I've played with some of them. They're great. There's a few of them that cost money, but they normally have demos for a period of time. The biggest issue is that the Ultra Recall app, there's not going to be a complete duplicate on the Mac. But I bet you'll get one that you'll feel comfortable with, and then you're going to have to make the migration. Of course, when you're dealing with this kind of thing, it's kind of like, you know, changing your hands, you know, all of a sudden having new hands. It's going to be really difficult to figure things out for a while, but then you'll get comfortable again, hopefully, because that's what happens when I change my hands.
or washing your hands.
You okay, let's do that,
I'm curious, which things are you using this for in regards to your scheduling or with regard to address book?
Meeting notes. Contents of websites, web pages that I find interesting, articles.
This is a really common desire for people. I know a lot of people that do these kinds of things. I normally use the apps in my computer to kind of manage multiple sources, but I'm very tied to, you know, so like my bookmarks are on Delicious and kind of mix them around. But I do have one that I use myself, which is an HTML document that self-edits itself, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. The one that I tried recently is called Personal Brain. That's a Macintosh application. And it is a paid application, but when I played with it, it was pretty cool. You could drag any kinds of files and it kind of indexes them and adds them. And
I guess what I wonder about is how much of this is covered by Spotlight?
It's not?
Okay.
It's not the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, you can add a category, you can tag it, you can grab a screen capture of a web page or, you know, the HTML capture of a web page and save into this document. So now you actually have a copy of that web page, which isn't really on your computer. That's the kind of thing you're looking to do, right?
And you can kind of use, you know, I could just go ahead and do everything in the iWork applications and then let the onboard search take care of that. But I wanted one place with one interface.
Yeah.
And yeah. I've been looking at Bento, and that's not quite there.
Yeah, I would. Have you tried the Apple site downloads and productivity?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, definitely go through that because there's going to be like five of them, and you can play around different ones. And I know people that use them. The thing that always gets me is that you definitely want, like, it's not a problem to pay for these apps because they're going to be so much a part of what you do on your computer that, you know, you can make an investment on it. And I would go ahead and I would definitely go ahead and don't let even $100 be an issue to an app like this, because if they're making money on it, it means they're going to be around longer. And if they're not making money, yeah, and you don't want the application after 2 years to fail, because then you're going to have to do another migration, which is a nightmare to do. And when you do this, anytime you have a large database kind of application, before you start using it, really take a look at the exporting and importing features of it, mostly the exporting features. So let's say you spend 2 years in this application that organizes your entire brain, and all of a sudden the company goes down or they don't release a new version or whatever. Can you get that data out effectively? And that's
a good point.
And that's something you want to look at right from the beginning, because it's going to affect you in 2 years and you want to know about it. So
Okay. Most
of these guys have export to HTML or export to XML, and if you can do that, then you can normally import that stuff back in. So make sure to take a look at that. You actually had a second call, but before you do that, where's Loveland, Colorado?
Loveland, Colorado is a small town just south of CSU in northern Colorado. Well, let's say 50 miles north of Denver.
North of Denver. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
How'd you
hear about GeekSpeak?
Oh, let's see. I believe I was doing podcast searches.
Uh-huh.
And I actually took a long road trip recently and downloaded, I think, 2 years' worth of podcasts. And that's what my wife and I listened to for all across the country.
Wait, cool. GeekSpeak or other podcasts?
No.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. Okay, so you have a second question for us?
Yes, I do. The other one is, this is a newbie Mac question, so I'm sure there's something simple. I have 5 or 6 or 7 different applications open at the same time, and through the course of switching around, I've minimized 1, 2, or 3, or 4 of them, and then I want to bring back, let's say, Pages, for example, which I had previously minimized.
Uh-huh.
I then do a command tab, and
it doesn't come up.
Right, well, because it's been minimized.
We kind of got lucky here. Ben Jaffe just walked in the room, and Ben works with me up at UCSC, and he knows a lot about Macintosh shortcuts and stuff. So, Ben, I'm going to repeat the question because I know you didn't get the headphones on exactly.
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, let me turn your mic up. Hi, Ben.
Hi, everyone.
So, Ben, the issue that Sean's having is, when he's in an application and he minimizes the window, like on Macintosh Pages, which is like a Word equivalent kind of thing, he minimizes the window and then he goes to a different application. When he tabs back, the window doesn't unminimize; it stays minimized. How can he get to that window through keystrokes?
Without a mouse. That's something that plagued me for a while, actually, and there's no good answer. It's a behavior that's default, and there's
I have a solution. So
I might have to. This is a
I do too.
Software
yeah.
add-on.
Yeah, oh, we all have solutions. Okay, well, we'll let Ben deal with it for a second. But yeah. Go ahead, write.
Well, kind of a shift of methodology how you do it. Instead of minimizing, do Control H to hide the application, and that way when you Control Tab or a Command Tab over to it, it will reappear.
That's what my suggestion was too. That's really good.
But minimizing, yeah, that's the behavior. It kind of sticks down in the dock and doesn't come out until you click on it.
So basically, people that use Macs a lot. With keystrokes, we just don't minimize any applications or any windows. We just do Command H is what he's suggesting, which hides the front application. The entire application's hidden, and then when you tab back to it, Command Tab back to it, it just is there again. So it never goes down to the dock. It never has those really cool animated effects.
Command Tab or Command H or Command or yep. Control H.
Command H.
Which is the cloverleaf key on the Mac that's right next to the spacebar.
Got it.
But there may definitely be some utility out there that will change the behavior. I don't think we're aware of
it. Yeah, it's funny. I think all of us ran into that problem, and so we just don't minimize anymore.
Well, we probably all came from the Windows world where that was the behavior where it would.
You know, it's interesting because sometimes I do minimize a window. Like when I've got a lot of Firefox different windows open, mm-hmm. and some of them are different tasks, and I've stopped doing that for a while, I'll minimize it, and then I completely forget about that window. I like just don't ever see it again. And so then I'm quitting Firefox, and it says, do you want to review your windows? I'm like, I don't have any windows open. Oh, I have four in my little dock thing. So thank you for that question, Sean. I hope that helped you out.
Well, it certainly did.
Thank you so much for listening to GeekSpeak, and I'm kind of flattered that you traveled the country and listened to GeekSpeak on podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. Yeah. It was the first time that I was able to that my wife actually sat down and listened to anything technical for a long period of time, and it's really interesting that this held her attention, and she really enjoyed it. It was entertaining.
And how's your marriage doing now?
Just fine still.
Sean, thanks so much. I hope you call again.
I will. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You can download like this, 4 or 5 years of GeekSpeak up on geekspeak.org if you're doing a road trip and want to listen to us forever.
Wow. I don't know about you, but I'm getting a swelled head.
Years ago, my man, years ago. Ben, you have another suggestion can you get a little closer to your mic? Pull your mic closer to you.
Oh, yeah. that works. I think I found the application somehow by chance. Google's amazing. It's called Witch, I think is what it is, WITCH. And it's a Mac OS application, which you can push a keyboard shortcut. I chose, instead of Command Tab, I chose Option Tab, and it'll come up with a list, a lot like a lot like Command Tab, but it'll show all the windows that are open, including the minimized ones. And then you can just cycle through to the one that you want to bring up and then let go, and it'll pop up.
Now, I do use that. I haven't tested that particular feature at all since I upgraded to Leopard. Did it actually restore minimized?
Yeah.
In Leopard?
I haven't tried it in Leopard, no.
Okay. I imagine it'd be the same.
I don't use it anymore. I really just stopped minimizing Windows.
Yeah. Well, I found Witch to be really useful because the Command Tab only takes you to your main window. If you have multiple windows, like if you're composing an email with Thunderbird or Mail, it will only bring up the main window. It doesn't bring up your sub-windows. So Witch is definitely good for giving you more granularity.
So, but you know about Command Tilde, right? Or Tick? That will cycle through your windows.
Yeah, but you know, I like the little
display.
Okay.
So on a Macintosh, what we're talking about, Command Tab kind of thing, is if you're on a Mac and you have multiple applications open, like you have your email client and you have your web browser up, instead of using your mouse to go to the dock to click on the different ones, you can actually put your left hand on the keyboard and put your thumb on the Command key, which is next to the space bar, and tap and hold that down while you push tab, and you will see a display of all the applications you have up, and you'll slowly select through them. When you release the Command key, it will select that application and it'll come to the front. It's a way of minimizing mouse movement, which is actually quite bad for your wrist. Or so Dr. Dawn says. I don't know if that, I shouldn't put words in her mouth. I'm assuming she does. All right, so let's go ahead and take the next call. From Aromas, Bob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I have a problem. I'm trying to install an external hard drive, and I bought the enclosure and the hard drive. It's an Seagate, and it's the E Theta, I pronounce it that way, and USB connectors, and I want to run it on E Theta. My motherboard has a connector to that. When I hooked it up, it didn't recognize it. But then I thought, okay, maybe the cable. So I tried the USB, and the USB, it did, but I can't get into it at all.
Okay, so you're on a Windows machine, correct?
Yes.
And you got a Seagate external hard drive that is USB and SATA.
SATA, okay.
Okay, we normally call it SATA. I'm assuming that's what he means.
He has eSATA.
eSATA, or extended SATA.
The external SATA.
External SATA. So does your computer have extended SATA as well? SATA ports on the outside of the computer?
Yes, it does.
Okay. This is interesting. So when you plug in the USB, I think you want to go ahead and format this drive through USB. I'm assuming that there's some problem with that issue. When you plug the drive in through USB, what occurs?
It recognized it, but that was as far as it went.
It recognizes the drive. Can you see? Does it show up in Explorer?
No, I looked it under my computer. Also, you know how it usually tells you the drive.
Yeah. So when you look under, so you saw it in my computer?
No,
you didn't. If you go under, the Start menu and then go to Control Panels, one of the choices there in Classic mode is System. What's that called?
system information. I looked it under that, and it showed my regular hard drive, then also the information on this hard drive. But the interesting thing, I don't know if it's interesting or not, but the partition that says zero SCSI bus not available is SCSI logic unit not available.
Oh, are you plugging? Are you plugging the SATA in and the USB in at the same time? The extended SATA and the USB?
No.
Okay, so so there's two different things going on. First off, it would be really nice to use the extended SATA because it's a much faster connection speed. You might have to enable the extended SATA in the BIOS. Unfortunately, this week Sean is not here. He knows all about this. He's the one that's really dealt with a lot of external SATA. You already said that.
That's the difference between the two. Is that one is internal to the device,
and there's nothing really different about them, right?
No, they're basically the same. The connector is slightly different shape, but it's basically the same signal.
Is the I think it's the same. I don't think it's a different shape. I think it's the same.
No, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. So this hard drive enclosure, does it have its own power source?
Yes.
Okay. So first off, I think you should shoot us an email so that we can get Sean to help you out on this problem, because I think it's going to be easier for him to tell you how to open up the BIOS and enable it, assuming that that's what the problem is. The second issue is that it sounds like there's something wrong in general with this drive. It should, from Seagate, have already come partitioned, okay, and you should be able to just mount it by plugging it in via USB. It really shouldn't be difficult in that regard. So that concerns me a little bit, that you're having trouble with that. And I would, at this point, take a look at the brochure that came with you and really, have you followed their instructions on hooking this drive up? Or did you buy the case separately from the hard drive?
Yeah, I bought the case separately.
Oh, great. Okay, so you just need to partition this hard drive. You just need to format this hard drive. I'm sure that's what it is. So, and you could go ahead and do that in any case, this drive's not going to show up in the Explorer until you partition it. So it is going to show up in the system administration disk tools. It should show up there as kind of like a big black block. And you need to right-click it or select it and save format. And go ahead and use, I guess, FAT32 would be fine. Once you've done that, now your machine, it should start working. Just make sure not to plug in the eSATA and the USB at the same time. Choose which one you want. And both of them can be hot-swapped, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. So
do you see it showing up there? Do you see it showing up in the system? Like, I can't remember the name of that thing. I'm dying here. You know what? I think we'll go ahead with the suggestion of sending us an email. Make sure that I can be in front of a Windows machine while I'm assisting you on this, because it's not.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what the issue is: formatting that drive, and then it should be work no problem.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again.
Thank you. Sorry for the delay on our answering you, but we will help you out.
Are you thinking about the computer management module?
Yeah. Yeah. What is that called? It's under system preferences or
it's
under control panel.
System administrator tools, and I think it's called computer management.
Computer management. Yeah. Under computer management.
And then there's a drive module within that.
Right. And that should show up. Like, I plugged in a drive that was actually a Macintosh formatted drive to my Windows last night through that. Yeah. And you know,
because the Explorer environment's only going to show you formatted drives.
Right. Mountable drives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Follow up quickly on that. I just loaded that Witch utility on Leopard. Works great. It does.
Great.
It does restore minimized when you alt tab.
How's Leopard working for you? Do you use Photoshop?
You know, it's got some bugs. I do not use Photoshop, so I'm dealing with some kind of fundamental core OS bugs that are driving me crazy.
Are you upset that you switched over?
No.
All right.
It's not that bad.
I'll be doing it this coming week. I just haven't gotten to it yet. We're too busy at work, right, Ben?
Me too.
Yeah. So we're taking calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, those phone numbers, nice and slow, 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, that's 655-KUSP. In the air with me, I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Ryder Brooks. And we're helping you with your technical dilemmas and problems, and hopefully not confusing more than we help. Let's go ahead and take a call from Watsonville, a regular caller to GeekSpeak. Hello, Judith.
Hi. I had a comment and then a question. The way I can get a minimized window to come back up with keystrokes is I've changed is to go to the dock. I think that the default one may be Control F3. I'm not sure. because I've changed it. I specialized my keystroke, so I do option D to get to the dock.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
But then you go to the dock, and then you just use the back, forward, back keys over, and you can...
And you use the dock, but with navigation tools. That's very that's very good.
That's a way to get to the minimized window, and then press return to open it up again.
You know what we need to do? I need to release, like, a really great, here's a whole bunch of keystroke stuff video for
yeah,
Mac.
Yeah, that'd be neat. But yeah, it's Control F3, move focus to the dock.
And then just use the direction button. Forward or back.
Yeah, cool.
Anyway.
Wow, you can even right select if you do that. You can left, you know, up and down select if you want to choose different things to do with that device.
Okay.
Neat.
Great.
Yeah. You can show in Finder.
New. That's awesome.
Hey, that's really cool. Thanks, Julie.
Oh, yeah. So I feel proud I've given some helpful hint to the geeks.
So Control F3, and if you're on a laptop, of course, using the laptop keyboard, you have to hold the function key.
Well, I got it mine so that I use the function key just to do the hardware things. So.
Yeah. But I like it.
Anyway, so that's one. The question that I had has to do with I just got a new headset for a cell phone, and the little jack when it plugs into the cell phone, it doesn't connect very easily. I don't know. Is there anything to do to make
it? Does it pull out really easily? Mean?
Well, it goes in. It's not like it pulls out. It just doesn't make contact and work very well.
And it's the right one for your phone?
I'm pretty sure.
What's that connector type called?
Oh, boy.
2.5 millimeter TS?
Yeah, Lal and I've had an ongoing debate about this. Yeah, it's 2.5 millimeters TS or TRS.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is there anything to do to
to make it work better?
I don't know whether you
think. Where did you buy the headset?
I bought it through Staples.
Okay, well, I would go back into Staples with your phone and go, hey, Staples people, and let them slowly open up different boxes of these headsets and try them. I bet you it's a different size than what your phone takes. And I would go ahead and return it. The other thing to do, what's the model of your phone?
Oh, it's an old thing.
An old thing?
Yeah.
let me Google that old thing phone.
It's a Motorola, but it's a very, you know, it's not a... It's an old one.
It's possible that the format of that phone, that connector, was not a standard size. It was
well,
not it's a 2.5.
The standard. The other standard ones I've gotten worked.
The other ones did.
Yeah, I had other ones. I just had one that sort of that finally died.
Oh, well, you know, if the connection works when you plug it in, but it's loose.
Sometimes I just have to hold it really tight or move it around, and it works. But
I mean, me being this kind of
lousy, I think it's a lousy one.
Here, I highly recommend not doing this. What you can do is you can look in the connector and see where the contacts actually are, and then around the sleeve part of it. That's the highest part up the connector. You'll see the connector has different metal points. You could add a piece of paper or glue a piece of
something
on that top. Yeah, aluminum foil would be good, I guess. On the top of it so that when you do push it in, it forces the connector to kind of bend inside the socket. The other thing you could do is you could put a slight bend in the actual connector. But both of these things are highly unsuggested. It's just that's what I would do.
Okay, anyway. I didn't know that there was any way of sort of helping it to function better.
Not really.
Okay.
Thank you, Judith, for the calls.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was really wonderful to get a call from a regular listener suggesting better keystrokes for us. I just love that. Ben and I are kind of addicted to really good keystrokes on a Macintosh, so we're always talking about it. The Geeks This Morning with Miles Elam, Ryder Brooks, and Ben Jaffe, and answering the phones was Rick Fellman. Thank you all for participating in Geek Speak.
Glad to be here.
Sure.
Yep.
Thanks for joining.
Pause.
Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Did I get everything today? Yes, I did. Good. Whew. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto, on the web at kosp.org. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.